Welcome to Air Quality Matters, and this is a conversation with Ian Mordit. An independent building performance researcher based in the UK, he specialises in the testing and monitoring of buildings to evaluate energy performance, indoor environmental quality and comfort. He is routinely involved in field-based building performance research programmes, and the outcomes of his research projects often help inform building standards. Ian has been a long-standing partner of the AECOM-led technical team, appointed to support the UK government, now the Building Safety Regulator, and separately the Welsh government, in developing revisions to Part F and Part L. More recently, Ian has developed formal guidance for the Future Home Standards, intended to reduce the performance gap and to improve ventilation standards during the retrofitting of existing buildings. I can't think of anyone in the UK that has spent more time poring over the wording of guidance documents and at the same time been on the ground monitoring the performance of ventilation systems. He has a genuinely unique perspective of the performance gaps we see and understanding of the potential for standards and guidance to address that gap or not. We speak about what goes wrong, how guidance is written to address performance, and ventilation, of course, and so much more. I hope you enjoy this one. Thanks for listening. This is Ian Mordit. I'm not sure when I think about it, Ian, if I can think of anybody else in the ventilation space, particularly in the UK, that spent so much time poring over the wording of, in particular, Part F, the building regulations for ventilation in the UK, or the guidance documents, I should say, but at the same time, been on the ground monitoring the outcomes of performance of ventilation in spaces, as you have. How do you think we're doing at meeting that intent today of the regulations compared to what you see on the ground?
Well, where are we today? I think today we're in a better place than we were, say, 10, 15 years ago. But we're nowhere near where we should be. There's been a lot of development in both technology, ventilation equipment. And the regulations have to try and keep up with what's coming onto the market as well. But there's quite a disconnect still between the intended outcomes, as you say. You know, what level of air quality are we after? Well, we outline what the minimum is in the building regulations in approved document F. And we would like industry, whether it's installers or manufacturers, to both provide products and install them in a way that meets that intent. I think some of the issue is less around how effective the regulations are, but more the implementation of those regulations, the enforcement of those regulations. That's where I see there's a need for greater improvement.
Yeah, there's a couple of really interesting points you raised there. One of them was the technological development over the last, let's say, 10 or 15 years. I mean, the danger is when you've been at it long enough, you can cast your mind back to big performance gaps maybe 10 years ago, and actually some of those may have been addressed with improvements in technology over that time. That may, you know, it may not be that the supply chains improved necessarily, but the hardware can improve to meet that. But it is down to implementation, isn't it? The when we look back historically at the guidance in regulations, apart from how they've been worded, they haven't changed an awful lot, have they, over the years? The core principles of ventilation, of exhaust ventilation and background ventilation, the kind of rates that you've required, they've largely been the same for decades, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, well, they have continued to be reviewed over the years. So if we rewind back to before I was involved in development of regulations, or the guidance around the regulations, there was a number of studies by predominantly in this country by the building research establishment, where they would carry out certain field studies in homes, look at the level of ventilation, and try and evaluate what's going on with the ventilation, the air tightness, and the indoor air quality. And one of the first studies in the context of modern homes, modern new dwellings anyway, was a study by VRE that looked at homes that were built since 1995. And that was one of the foundation studies that I started looking at, where you could see that you've got a number of homes that have been built to, we didn't have great air tightness standards then. And actually a lot of the homes in that study had a air permeability, you know, they were very leaky, had an air permeability of greater than 12. But nonetheless, the ventilation provision in those homes didn't meet the guidance that was in approved document F at the time. And the criteria mainly in approved document F really was to meet a minimum moisture standard, because moisture is the predominant pollutant in a home environment. And that's what part F at the time was really looking to control. And it's worth really looking at what the regulation requires here for ventilation, because it simply says that there shall be adequate ventilation for people in buildings. That's what the regulation says. That's regulation F1. And I guess all the guidance then in the approved document that supports that regulation hinges around the word adequate. What do we mean by adequate? And within the framework of the building regulations, of course, with whether we're talking fire or whether we're talking structure or ventilation or whatever the standard you're looking at for building regulations, in the UK, it's around minimum standards, setting the minimum standard. You can do no worse than the guidance that supports that regulation. You can always do better. And in many ways, this is some of the issue with the regulations and industry's response to those regulations, that rather than seeing it as a minimum standard, they see the regulations or the guidance for the regulations as being a recipe. So they use it as a specification rather than thinking, oh, actually, Part F says we need to provide a certain amount of ventilation for homes as a minimum requirement, and we need to provide, you know, X number of liters per second in certain rooms for extract ventilation or whatever the criteria. There's very little projects, properties out there that have been designed to be better than that. If we exclude, say, passive house homes, which have they still need to meet that minimum requirement, but they have much higher standards, certainly in terms of their quality, and have better outcomes as a result of that quality process that they follow. So yes, it's whether the regulations need greater enforcement, and whether we need to find ways to work with industry, and with the compliance bodies, whether it's building control bodies, to ensure that the minimum standards are met, and encourage better than the minimum, rather than having a race to the bottom to see how much you can get away with.
Yeah, no, completely. And it goes to quite a philosophical point, I think, around what the intention of regulations is and what they're really capable of doing. Even a term like adequate ventilation or adequate air quality is naturally a moving target, because our understanding of what adequate is changes as science improves and our ability to measure air quality improves. Like you say, back in the BRE days in the early 90s, predominantly we were concerned about moisture management in buildings. Whereas today we have much deeper understanding of some of the other pollutants of concern that we need to care about, like outdoor air quality, nitrogen dioxides, mm-hmm. formaldehydes, particulate matter, you know, the list goes on. So the definition of adequacy can change subtly and not subtly over time. And it's industry's job to move with that. The regulations have to define something. So they will define in words, as you say, the regulations is only a couple of paragraphs. It's thou shalt not suffocate people in the building and turn it into a mushroom farm, effectively. The guidance documents there are there to provide a framework, aren't they, for people to have an understanding of how you might meet the intent of those regulations. But it's, as you say, that disconnect between understanding that it's a minimum bar, it's on a broad set of assumptions, this is what we advise you do from a performance perspective in the space, that's not a high bar. And I guess what you've seen on the ground over the years is it being seen as the line just to achieve and regularly falling short of that.
Yes, and that's why we're continually involved with field studies, or not continually, but regularly involved with field studies, where we try to gather more performance data in homes. So going back to that 1995 study, one of the findings from that study was really, you know, to help the development of what was the then 2006 Part F, because up until that point it was moisture was the focus, but there was increasing concerns nonetheless at that time that there's more than moisture that we need to be worried about, and you know, is it pollutants from cooking activities or from heating activities, and also background emissions from chemicals and formaldehyde, particulate matter. And of course, there is an assumption, and there still is today in the regulations, that the outdoor air is clean. So we take that as being fresh air. We can debate that at length, as to whether we should consider looking at the external air quality. In the current ADF, there is a section on external pollutants and about how to minimise the ingress of external pollutants. But that study in 1995 was then used as a basis to change the 2006 guidance, which started to consider other indoor-borne pollutants such as nitrogen dioxide and so on. Fast-forwarding from that, there was then, when I first then got involved, was the 2010 study, which was to evaluate homes that had been built to the 2006 revision of approved document F. And that was a relatively small study to, again, evaluate what the ventilation provision was in the homes, what the indoor air quality was like in those homes. But by and large, one of the biggest findings actually in that study was the level of non-compliance. And that level of non-compliance then made it difficult for us to assess what our primary research objective was, which is the guidance that was in the 1996 revision of approved document F, was that sufficient for more airtight modern homes from an air quality perspective? But of course, if we found that the number of homes that we studied, that we went into and looked at the ventilation provision and how it's being used, which is a sort of separate question, but obviously important if residents aren't going to use their ventilation provision. But if they don't have adequate provision in the first place, then we couldn't really evaluate our primary objective, which is essentially is ADF fit for purpose in modern airtight homes. So that actually then set a the recommendation from that study was to set a new regulation, which is now what's regulation 42 and 44 in the building regulations, which is about the requirement to test and commission ventilation systems in new homes. And that still stands today.
And I think that's a learning that is happening across the world, is this performance gap between the intention of the regulations and what we find on the ground. I've lost count of the amount of conversations I've had with academics and researchers over the years that have gone in to do a study on indoor air quality in any number of scenarios you can imagine, from retrofit to new build to schools to public buildings. And they spend 95% of their time trying to figure out why the ventilation didn't comply, not on whether the air quality performance was meeting what they expected. And it just goes to show that you have to have a robust strategy at the beginning of a research study to figure out what you're going to do if you find non-compliance, because otherwise all you do is you spend your time studying crap ventilation, basically. And is it any surprise that you get poor performance when you're measuring non-compliant ventilation for a whole range of reasons? You know, and I think, are you referring to the ventilation in new homes study? Was it that one that you were referring to? Indoor air quality in new homes.
Well, there's two of them. There's the one in 2010 that was carried out, and there was a follow up one in, I think it was in 2015, which was published in 2019. So that's probably the more recent study. That was a larger study. And the intention of that study was to, given our disappointment in the previous study about the levels of non-compliance, that we was then used as a basis to advise the government that we needed greater regulation for testing and commissioning. The intention being that if you get to the end of the process, when you commission a ventilation system and it doesn't meet the minimum requirements, then you can do something about it. But in this 2015 study, however, we recruited, I think it was about 80 homes. And in that study, we found that there's still very significant levels of non-compliance. So that was a disappointment. We didn't think it was nailed by having a regulation that says it must be testing commissioned. We thought it would, you know, because the regulation's only as good as compliance. And if there's lack of enforcement, then industry's not going to gear up and meet the regulation if they're not required to. If building control don't ask for commissioning data, then you're going to have a period of non-compliance. So that second study really then was used to look at, the first thing we did in that study, we looked at a number of homes. Again, the intention was for airtight new dwellings. And it was also for the homes that we felt that were at greatest risk of poor indoor air quality, which was naturally ventilated homes. But we managed to capture a number of mechanically ventilated homes in the study. I think around about a third of them ended up being mechanically ventilated using decentralized mechanical extract ventilation. So whilst you don't get in these, a lot of these studies, nothing's perfect when you're doing a field study. And you might not be able to answer your primary objectives. The data you still get from these properties, from these studies, it's still golden. You can use it to inform secondary objectives or even objectives that you didn't think you were going to find out initially when you set out to do the study. Having that data and understanding what's happening with ventilation rates, with the air exchange rates, if you're doing tracer gas measurements, with the pollutants that are being sampled, the temperature humidity data, the occupant interaction and use of the ventilation systems, and other contextual data of the property. It's incredibly valuable and helps to build a portfolio on what's happening out there.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Do you think that there's any evidence that without enforcement, that improvements to regulations over time has an incremental impact in the quality of ventilation on the ground? Because it would seem from the studies, like your first study, the one in 2015 that was published in 2019, I'm thinking Scotland's just done a study with Tim Sharp that looked at regulations as late as 2019, 2020, after the implementation of CO2 sensors in bedrooms in an update in their regulations. And again, found, I think it was 75% of the homes underventilated. So is it unfair to say that you're wasting your time improving regulations if there's no policing or control or mechanism to check that you're getting what you designed and paid for? Or have you seen any evidence over those 10 years or so that changes in words on a document somewhere could improve an outcome on the ground?
There has been improvement, and what I don't want to do at all is to come across as, you know, bashing building control and saying they're not doing their job adequately. I mean, yes, developers are in many cases getting away with not meeting the regulations. If I stick with Part F in particular, you know, we've seen plenty of developments today and in previous studies where non-compliance has been poor. But the landscape in which building control have to work is extremely challenging. There's an awful lot of specialisms out there. A lot of building control officers will be, maybe from a building background, but to expect them to understand every single aspect of all of the approved documents and the minimum requirements in all of those, it is highly challenging, and I wouldn't want to do their job, quite frankly. Plus the fact that they have a fee cap that doesn't allow them to charge greater fees to do all this checking. So it's not really that's part of the issue, but some of the main issue is this race to the bottom, where developers are looking for ways to meet the minimum requirement or get away with the absolute minimum, and if they don't even meet that requirement, then as long as they can get away with it, then that's okay. So I think there should be greater onus on developers and installers, all those stakeholders involved with delivery, whether it's, you know, in the design, the installation, the commissioning, the maintenance. All of those stakeholders need to be satisfied that they are meeting that minimum requirement, not just hope that building control will just accept their commissioning documentation and have a desktop exercise and they've got away with it. But there certainly needs to be more enforcement to ensure that what's being claimed is actually delivered.
I think you're right. And the building control shouldn't be seen as the linchpin here. That they, you know, really they're the final arbiter of control, but there should be collective accountability right across the supply chain. And what we're talking about here to be brutal, is a long history of very poor performance of ventilation systems right across the board. We're not just talking about developers and large-scale new build. I mean, they get a bashing, and rightly so, for the some of the quality of output that they produce, not just in ventilation. But we see it in retrofit. We see it in the renovation of buildings. We see it in the maintenance of ventilation systems. It's just a given, really, at this stage, that we see widespread non-compliance of meeting, getting anywhere near minimum standards sometimes. And we have to be aware that poor indoor air quality is the single biggest environmental risk we face. Like, this stuff is really serious. Like, the health implications of this stuff is significant. And what we're talking about isn't that complicated. I was just talking to you before we were going live about what it says about the intent of the regulations. This stuff isn't rocket science. Like, we know how to do it. And you and I and everybody is seeing really good examples, from passive house to developments where there's been a real onus on quality of outcomes, an ability to meet and exceed the intent of the regulations easily. And it comes down to decent local exhaust ventilation, good background ventilation, an ability to purge when you need to, thinking about outdoor air pollution, thermal comfort, noise. This stuff isn't complex, is it, really?
No, it's not. And I think one of the changes that was made in the current edition of ADF, the 2021 edition, that was the first revision that took into account the Hackett review after Grenfell. And one of the requirements or recommendations from that review was to ensure that any guidance in the approved documents was simplified, that it was clear to follow. I mean, personally, I don't like the term simplified. I'm much rather to say it's clarified, that the what you're asking people to do is made very clear and unambiguous. And to be fair, the previous revision of ADF, the 2010 revision, some of the complaints, if you like, from users of that document, whether it's builders, whether it's building control or designers, whoever was using that document, needed to follow that guidance. It was quite, I wouldn't say complicated. Everything had a process to follow. And so you could design the number of ventilators you needed. You could design the amount of fan flow rate that was needed to meet the performance criteria. But the main challenge with that one was, what does compliance look like? So how do you go into a completed home, inspect the ventilation system, and check that off to say that, yes, it meets that guidance? Because the only way you could do that is either if you had the original design documentation, or if you were prepared to stand in that building and do calculations to say, yes, it's got the this size floor area, this number of bedrooms, and this number of ventilators, and therefore it meets the minimum free area requirements for ventilating that home. So the 2021 edition took a lot of that guesswork out, that it's now you're more likely to be possible for you to stand in a building and look at the ventilation provision and look at the tables in the approved document to say, yep, that building meets that requirement from a visual inspection perspective, and then a follow-up with commissioning data on any mechanical items to show that they've been commissioned correctly. So that's improved quite significantly. But as you say, what's being asked for in the approved documents, it's not difficult. You know, we're looking to, you know, address that word adequate in ventilation in buildings and provide guidance for the minimum amount of fresh air that's needed, the minimum amount of extract air to make sure you've got the right balance between fresh air coming into the building and stale air leaving the building. That's really it, you know? So it's not complex.
And it is based on a broad set of assumptions. So it is quite a simple process and people need to recognize it as that. I think over time we will see a movement towards specific indoor air quality parameters or specific performance-based criteria as we get a better understanding of air quality and as we get the tools to measure it more effectively. But at the moment, we're just talking about air movement, principally, with a consideration for some air pollution characteristics from outside. But the technical guidance documents are really just talking about how much air does a building need, how much air do we need to exhaust out of areas that are creating pollution, how much purge ventilation do we need to provide for specific events like painting or overheating or whatever it is, and have a mind to accessibility for maintenance and, you know, the noise generation from products and so on. It's all really common sense stuff. The question has to be asked then at that point is, does it just come down to how people value ventilation as to whether this is implemented? Because it's not a big ask to achieve 0.3 litres a second per square metre or 26 litres a second for a two-bedroom house or whatever the rates in the guidance are. Yet time and time again, when we go on the ground, we see that those numbers, those basic numbers that are based on broad sets of assumptions, they're nothing spectacular, aren't being met. And they're not being met in a determined way that somebody's made a calculation and gone, I think actually I can get away with 24, not 26. And these are my reasons why, because it should be said in the regulations, you always have the ability to do that. You can always seek expert advice. You can always take alternative approaches and use experts to guide you. But we're not seeing shortfalls in ventilation rates based on that. We're seeing it because, as you said, I think in the 2015 study, you mentioned that about a third of those properties were decentralized mechanical extract systems. That wasn't by design, was it? They suddenly figured out that, oh, we thought we had natural ventilation. We've actually got permanently on fans. Maybe it's DMEV. Like, there's some really fundamental mistakes being made out there, aren't there?
There are, and those mistakes still continue. You know, I still see projects coming across my desk, which all the intention is right, but there's just a fundamental lack of understanding of what the guidance is asking for. And I think one of the main things I see most commonly when I review a design or, you know, measure a flow rate in a completed building is the installation has always been set up. I'm talking about mechanical ventilation systems here, have always been set up to meet the extract requirements because moisture, as I said earlier, is historically the main pollutant in homes, and that's where a lot of the guidance in approved document F originated, was to deal with moisture and the requirement to remove moisture at source rather than let it become widespread throughout the dwelling. So that's why we have extract fans in bathrooms and in kitchens. And there's still that mentality, I think, those fans just do one speed and they will deliver a certain extract rate depending on what room it is. And that rate is tabulated in approved document F. And as long as you meet that, then you've met the requirement. Now that fans are becoming more sophisticated, we're getting away from those sort of horrid, in my opinion anyway, bathroom fans that switch on and wake everyone up in the middle of the night and then stay on for 15 minutes or so afterwards. But those really are peak moisture extract devices. They don't provide background ventilation rates, whereas decentralized MEV systems, mechanical extract ventilation fans, they're designed to do that, but also to have a lower rate, which is meant to meet the minimum background ventilation requirement. So therefore, they're on a trickle rate, or whatever you want to call it, a low speed, 24/7. And that's the bit that I find is almost constantly non-compliant. And actually, there's another study that I did with Zero Carbon Hub in, I think that was in 2015 also, from memory, where that was a bit more of a lifting the bonnet on the homes that we went into, because we went in during construction after second fixed stage when the ducting had been put in, and then through to completion on these homes where we were able to interview the commissioning engineers. And those two commissioning engineers I spoke to on that study and said, you know, I was there as an observer, just trying to understand what processes they went through. And not only were they using inadequate commissioning equipment that had been incorrectly set up, so they weren't actually measuring volume flow rate, they were measuring velocity, they didn't even understand that these fans in these studies, which were MEV ventilated homes or MVHR ventilated homes, they didn't understand that there was two speeds. They were only commissioning the extract speed, which is the higher speed. The background ventilation rate, I asked this one guy, I said, so how do you measure the background ventilation rate? He said, oh, we don't need to measure that. There's no requirement to measure that. I said, well, what do you do? How do you set it up then? He said, well, I just use my ear. And as soon as I can't hear it, then I know there's not going to be any complaints from the residents. So when I actually did get a volume flow hood on that device and measured it, it was like not even pulling 1 liter a second. It was just almost no ventilation, no airflow through that device. So I think that is some of the issue, that there's what I would like more is people to actually read the approved documents, you know, because it's all there. And it, as you said, you know, it's pretty much in plain English now. It's very easy to understand if you just simply picked it up and turned the pages and read them. There's not a lot that's there to confuse you anymore, but people don't. And I don't know how you improve that without greater enforcement.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if there's a kind of a short form version of the regulations that can be produced. I know when I do some of my training, I do a section on regulations, but the bits you really need to concentrate on for people that aren't the practitioners, for people that just need an understanding and often hold the accountability card in these projects. So the people that are going, well, hang on a minute, how much is this doing? Is that enough? Will that product be able to do that at a sound level that is going to be acceptable? There's lots of people like that involved in the supply chain that don't necessarily need to know all of the sections of the technical guidance documents, but need to know the intent, need to know the main headline numbers and be able to go, well, what have you set the whole house rate at? And a little bit it is in the traditional language, I think, as well. We talk about the low rate or the minimum rate, but we often find, and in the vast majority of cases actually, that the whole house ventilation rate or the minimum rate or whatever you call it in your jurisdiction is often greater than the boost rate or the high rate for the exhaust areas of the property. So when you calculate how much air a building needs as a whole, as its background ventilation rate, and you divide that rate by the number of extracts that you've got in a building, it's very, very common that rate that you should set that fan to, if it's not all higher than, say, 8 liters a second in a bathroom, which is the high rate, it might be very close. Or if it's lower, it's often very close to it as well. So I think we the traditionally the language confused that, but I think that's much clearer, I would say, in the new regulations, that it's a very simple process. Look, you need to look at how big a building is, how many people are likely to be in it. There's a couple of calculations to figure out what the whole house rate is. You, if you need to pick up your phone to do that calculation, so be it, but like, this isn't complex stuff. And then you just need to make sure that it's, if it's not already doing the high rates that are set for the bathrooms and the kitchens, that there's an ability to boost to that rate if you need to in those spaces. It's not hard stuff. It's just, as you say, people kind of have gone into it. And I, like you, I still have conversations today with people who go, well, it does 8 liters a second when someone presses the button, so it complies. You go, okay, that's half of it, but you know, what's it doing now? And another common problem, I don't know if you find this, is because there isn't much importance placed on ventilation, it seems, within the supply chain, there isn't much if you don't start from a performance perspective, you find that the choices of products don't reflect the performance very well. So we often find, for example, with DMEV fans, that they're not really capable of doing the flow rates. The choices that have been made of those fans aren't really capable of achieving the whole house flow rates at a sound level that would be acceptable for people to leave them on. And there is an alternative version of that very same fan that is capable of doing it. They would have just had to have drilled a bigger hole to achieve that. But nobody thought of that. It was I need a fan, a DMEV fan. I've always used that one. We'll just chuck one of those in. And it's not gone, well, actually, what do I need this to do? Isn't a question that is asked very often in building, I don't think.
It isn't, and let's just talk for a minute about decentralized MEV, particularly for people who might be listening who are less familiar with the terms we're talking. But the decentralized MEV fan is a very convenient product for a number of reasons. One, it's almost a straightforward replacement for an intermittent extract fan, if that's the sort of device that is, particularly in a retrofit context. You know, you've got a fan in the kitchen or in the bathroom, it's through the wall, or, you know, got a small amount of ductwork, maybe even ceiling mounted to the outside. So if you've got an intermittent extract fan, it's quite an easy swap over to have a decentralized fan. But what people are unaware of often is that by changing that fan, they've changed the ventilation strategy of the home. So no longer have they just got a simple on-off fan that is a moisture extract device. It's doing moisture extract, but it's also doing, or supplementing at least, the background ventilation. And so therefore, there's a requirement really to check, have you got ventilators in the habitable rooms so you can get a fresh air draw that's created by that fan, through the bedrooms and living rooms and so on, through into that wet room to extract to outside, and B, to make sure you've got none of those ventilators in that wet room, otherwise you'll just be pulling fresh air in from the bathroom window and out through the fan. So there's a bit of a misunderstanding about what the actual concept is for those fans. And the reason they're very popular is, well, firstly, they're fairly cheap to make and fairly cheap to buy. They're quite cheap to install, particularly if you're just doing a swap out, compared to a centralized MEV system where you have to have ducting to a central fan that's in a storeroom or in the loft or wherever. But the main disadvantage I found, and we did find this in the 2015 study when we sort of mistakenly recruited a number of decentralized MEV ventilated properties, is that the fan is room side. So with a centralized MEV fan, you've got a fan in a fan box, usually an acoustically treated fan box, and that's then in an enclosure somewhere. And the noise issue, generally speaking, if assuming it's designed and installed satisfactorily, will be very minimal. Whereas with a decentralized fan, it's the same principle, but it's local to the room that it serves. And the fan is located within the room. So it makes a greater noise. And that's by and large been the biggest complaint from a consumer perspective about these fans, is that when they start using them, they're told that they've got to be on 24/7. And if it's commissioned to do, you know, provide the minimum ADF guidance of 0.3 litres per second per square metre background ventilation rate, then it's making a whirring noise constantly. So the response by a lot of consumers over the years has been simply to switch those off. So then you're left with no background ventilation provision, or very inadequate background ventilation provision. And that's what we were finding in those studies. That's, you know, no surprise that the air quality was poor. But what's happened in more recent years, there's the response from the supply chain, is that fans are improving all the time, whether it's improvements in the impeller design to make them more efficient. And also there's been other criteria that decentralized mechanical extract fans have to meet, which is to ensure that they have a 20 Pascal back pressure test. And now to ensure that we have adequate ventilation rates through those fans at the background ventilation setting, and to make sure that they also operate fairly quietly, some of the manufacturers are now increasing the fan sizes from a 4-inch fan to a 5-inch fan. And so that's a big improvement. And that's possibly been more consumer-driven rather than regulation-driven, I would say, in that case.
Yeah, I think having spoken to some of the manufacturers, it's also accountability-driven. I think that market has been opened up within social housing, particularly for decentralized mechanical extract fans. And they have had to provide products that are significantly more robust for that space, that can move more air and do it quietly, because people aren't moving in necessarily to a new property and that's just what they've got. And so they've started out with that. These things are being replaced in properties. And if you've gone from an intermittent fan to a continuously running fan, there's now a noise there that wasn't there before. That, like you say, the consumers have driven that, and the consumers being the social housing providers as well have said, look, we need to move enough air and we need to do this quietly. So quietly in the background, those manufacturers have been improving those products. So if we were having this conversation even 6 or 7 years ago, it would have been a very different conversation. You know, there are several products on the market now that certainly, in theory at least, can produce the kind of flow rates that we see we need, particularly in retrofit. And that's something else I think for people to understand, is that in modern new builds, we've got quite wet room happy in our designs. You know, most properties go in now with an ensuite in at least one bedroom. You'll have a main bathroom. You'd almost certainly have a utility, very often a WC downstairs and a kitchen. So you can have 4 or 5, even 6 wet areas or extract points in a building quite commonly. But when we're retrofitting and dealing with existing properties, very often you might only have 2, but a main bathroom and a kitchen, which means the amount of air those 2 extracts have to move is significantly more than they would have to if they were part of 5 or 6 extract fans spread around the property. So there's more pressure on them to deliver. And, you know, it's very common when I'm like you, I see drawings coming across my desk all the time where you see decentralized MEV fans being asked to deliver 13, 14, 16 liters a second, continuous whole house rate each. Like, you're not going to do that with the little 4-inch DMEV fan that would have traditionally been put in a property, certainly not at a noise level that would be acceptable to people. So they've had to improve, particularly in that space, if they're going to operate within the retrofit space. But as you say, it's not just the fan, the technology, it's also the recognition of how that system works. And I think a lot of the failures that you saw in your studies were fundamental failures of concepts of design. So inlets in rooms where there shouldn't have been inlets, lack of undercuts and air transfer devices between spaces, the basics just weren't being picked up, were they?
No, absolutely. And this is some of the issue with the ventilation system that's a bit more unique compared to other services that are regulated services. So, you know, a heating system, you know, a heating engineer will design and install a complete system. The boiler, the pipeworks, the radiators, the controls. They might need to work with an electrician for part of it, but it's the whole process is supervised by a person or a single company. When it comes to ventilation in homes, that's not really the case. That, you know, the fan is part of the system, the ventilator is part of the system, the whole building is the system, and you've got different stakeholders, and it's a very fragmented process. So you may have an electrician wiring up the fan, the window manufacturer will provide the ventilator. You might have carpenters or chippies, you know, putting in the ducting, and then there'll be a different commissioning person at the end. So it's a very fragmented process, and the weak link in my view, in nearly all of the studies I've looked at, and other, you know, properties over the years, whether they're part of a major study or just individual complaints from residents that are trying to understand why the air quality in the home is so poor. And the weak link is always the ducting, nearly always the ducting. Often it's an inadequate sized fan unit that's been put in. And it's that installation of the ducting that is not really adequately controlled. So I think what's needed here is to have a body that it doesn't need to be anyone new in the process, but someone who takes responsibility for, you know, has stewardship of the entire installation and commissioning phase of the ventilation system, you know, to ensure that when it's handed over, that it's going to perform reasonably well, and that the commissioning engineer doesn't need to turn the fan to full duty, so it's whistling like a banshee, just to deliver the minimum flow rates, because the first thing that's going to happen is a resident will switch off a system like that. And usually when you have to commission a system to higher fan rates than are necessary, you know, but it's usually the ducting that is the cause for that.
On a new build project, is there someone that has overall responsibility for the compliance of that project, or does it fall to the separate individual trades or engineers or architects responsible for their parts? How would that be done? Because certainly in Ireland, we know we have Statutory Instrument 9, which makes the professional bodies, the architects, engineers and surveyors and developers, for example, responsible for absolute compliance of that building as a whole. And they would obfuscate some of that responsibility to professionals within certain sectors, but they still have to sign off the ultimate responsibility over it. Because I think it's interesting to unpack a little bit of what you said there. And for listeners to kind of grasp this concept perhaps a little bit, that forget air quality for the moment, but just the aerolic, the air performance of a ventilation system in a home is a result of the system as in its entirety. So that comes down to air paths within that property, how leaky that property is, where the air transfer devices are between spaces, the ducting, as you say, the windows, the where air comes into the property on purpose. there's a whole number of things that will contribute to the effectiveness of ventilation in a home. And the challenge with ventilation, unlike plumbing and heating or construction or roofing, comes under a number of different trades. There's never really been a ventilation trade as such in construction in the UK, has there? And you know, a good analogy or good example of that is one of the core components of success of ventilation is where air comes in. And window manufacturers, if they're not thinking about it, it's easier for them just to chuck a vent on every window, because then they don't have to think which windows need a vent or not. So very often we see non-compliance for continuous mechanical extract systems as a result of the fact that just every window came with a window vent in it, regardless of whether it was a kitchen window or a bedroom window. And that's a really good example. And joiners aren't necessarily thinking about whether they should have a 10 mil undercut above a finished floor surface. Nobody's thought that far ahead during the construction process to go, well, hang on a minute, we're providing an unfinished floor here. What do I need to do to make sure that I've got decent air transfer between spaces? It's very disjointed, isn't it, when you unpack it?
It is very disjointed. And so it is about contract procurement processes that are really under scrutiny here or should be under greater scrutiny to make sure that there are greater processes within a development. You know, at the moment, the developer takes sole responsibility for ensuring that what they've built and handed over meets all aspects of the building regulations. So that they're, you know, it's not building control that are responsible for it. It is the developer that's responsible for ensuring that they've built that. But how we get away from the fragmentation, I think you're right. I mean, it does need to be, there needs to be someone taking stewardship for that entire installation. And this is assuming, of course, that they've got an adequate design to install and commission to in the first place. So once it hits site, there needs to be a person that is responsible for the entire, you know, not just the fan box and the ventilators. It's the undercuts. It's the even looking at the air tightness. Has the air tightness been achieved, and therefore is this ventilation strategy that's been installed, is that still adequate for this type of property? There wasn't an official role. If we take air tightness as an example, when Partel started introducing air tightness requirements for buildings to make them less leaky, then it took a long time for the industry to start building adequately airtight homes, more airtight homes. And that has improved significantly over the sort of 20 years now since airtightness standards started coming into Part L. They came in 2006 for homes, and 2002, I think it was, for all other buildings. But it's taken the industry that long to get to a point where we were building homes with an air tightness of about between 12 and 15 meters cubed per hour per meter squared, 50 pascal fan test, down to, I think the average for new homes now is around about 4. So it's been a huge shift. And some of the reason for that air tightness becoming building being built more airtight now is there is a greater focus on compliance, because it is part of the criteria to deliver a building that meets a certain standard. So, and a lot of the trades are involved, whether it's electricians and plumbers that are punching holes through an airtight building to put their cables and pipes through it. There's a greater understanding now with those trades that the impact of the work that they carry out to ensure that the building is more airtight. And also, if we look at the passive house standards, you know, you'll have an air tightness champion involved to ensure that everyone's behaving themselves and not doing silly things to an airtight building. And I think that mentality has switched across to the mainstream building sector. So we're seeing greater levels of airtightness. So coming back onto ventilation, things are improving. It's a lot slower and it's not at the same pace as, you know, we're building it, buildings a lot more airtight more quickly, but we haven't caught up quite at the same pace with the ventilation. And to provide, someone who on any every development who is signing off every aspect of the ventilation system, I think that is, you know, a ventilation champion rather than an air tightness champion, or it could be the same role, would be a positive step.